Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment, we're going to begin a reading of the article you heard described by Dr. Michael Parenti, the article that he co-authored with colleague Peggy Noton. By the way, Peggy Noton's last name, N-O-T-O-N. This article is about the life and death and probable assassination of Walter Reuther, the very famous, or at least famous to those familiar with American labor history, leader of the United Auto Workers Union. This article is entitled The Wonderful Life and Strange Death of Walter Reuther. It was co-authored by Dr. Michael Parenti and Peggy Noton. The article was published in Covert Action Quarterly, number 54. That is the issue from the fall of 1995. The first segment of the article details Walter Reuther's travails during the course of his career as a labor organizer. It touches briefly on the circumstances surrounding his death and talks about earlier attempts on not only his life, but the life of his brother, Victor. The article begins, "In recent decades, organized labor has endured a serious battering by conservative interests in government and the corporate world. As progressives in the AFL-CIO try to rally their forces, they would do well to remember those few specially gifted union leaders who understood the broader social and political dimensions of the labor struggle. Among such leaders looms the great figure of Walter Reuther. His life and death contain lessons relevant to today's struggle. Rising from the ranks to spearhead the creation of the United Auto Workers, or UAW, Reuther brought a special blend of unfaltering progressivism and efficacy to the U.S. political scene. For this, he earned the wrath of powerful corporate and political interests. On the evening of May 9, 1970, Reuther, his wife, two close UAW associates, and the plane's two-man crew were killed when their chartered Learjet crashed near the Emmett County Airport in northern Michigan. The brief flight had originated in Detroit and was coming in through the mist on an instrument landing when it plowed into the treetops and burst into flames. There were no survivors. A year and a half earlier, in October of 1968, Reuther and his brother Victor had barely escaped death in a remarkably similar incident while flying into Dulles Airport outside Washington, D.C., again in a small private plane. On that night, the sky was clear enough for the pilots to realize that their altimeter was malfunctioning, and at the last moment they managed a crash landing that smashed a wing of the plane but left no one seriously injured. Years later, Victor Reuther, Walter's brother, told us, quote, "I and other family members were convinced that both the fatal crash and the near-fatal one in 1968 were not accidental," unquote. Any number of highly placed persons might have wanted Walter Reuther out of the way. Indeed, there is evidence of foul play against him through much of his public life, and evidence of sabotage in the fatal crash itself. The next segment of Parenti and Noton's article is entitled The Early Struggle, and it reads, 8 months before his death, Reuther reflected, quote, "The labor movement is about changing society. What good is a dollar an hour more in wages if your neighborhood is burning down? What good is another week's vacation if the lake you used to go to, where you've got a cottage, is polluted, and you can't swim in it, and the kids can't play in it? What good is another $100 pension if the world goes up in atomic smoke?" Reuther was the kind of labor leader who most discomforted the higher circles, militant, incorruptible, and dedicated to both the rank and file and a broad class agenda. The son of a German immigrant who was a lifelong socialist and labor organizer, Reuther devoted his life to the labor struggle. In 1932, after being fired from his job at a Ford plant because of his unionizing efforts, Walter departed with Victor on a 3-year trip around the world. Their itinerary included a prolonged stint as workers in a Ford plant in the Soviet Union. Writing to a friend back in the States, Reuther described Soviet society in enthusiastic terms. The letter, which he signed Vic and Wall, later was doctored in a number of places. Most notably, its closing comment, "Carry on the fight," was changed to "Carry on the fight for a Soviet America," unquote. The FBI had the original letter written in its internal files, but circulated only the forged one to political leaders, corporate heads, and rival unionists in an attempt to show that Walter was a communist tool. Returning to Detroit in late 1935, Walter and Victor emerged as leaders in the often bloody struggle against the automotive bosses, winning landmark victories against Chrysler, GM, and Ford. In May of 1937, during a major leafleting effort, Reuther and dozens of other UAW organizers were assaulted by Ford's thugs. Testifying at a federal hearing, Reuther described how he and his companions were repeatedly punched, kicked, and slammed against the concrete floor, then thrown down several flights of stairs while the police stood by doing nothing. In April of 1938, two masked gunmen forced their way into Reuther's Detroit home during a party and attempted to abduct him. While they were trying to beat Reuther into submission, one guest managed to flee and summon help. The assailants were eventually arrested, but their trial proved to be a sham. Facing a jury packed with Ford sympathizers, the defense argued that Walter had staged the whole event as a publicity stunt. The state prosecutor neglected to mention that Reuther's organizing activities had made him a target at Ford, and that both of the accused recently had been working for Ford security chief Harry Bennett. The jury acquitted the two men. No one could claim that another attack a decade later was staged. In April of 1948, Reuther was nearly killed by a shotgun blast fired through his kitchen window. He suffered chest and arm wounds and never recovered the full use of his right arm and hand. An attempt on Victor Reuther's life the following year suggests outright complicity by law enforcers. Victor began receiving calls from the Detroit police telling him that neighbors, whom the police refused to name, were complaining about his dog barking. In fact, the dog had occasionally barked at night. When Victor would go out to investigate, he would see a parked car start up and speed away. After the police issued a, quote, final warning, unquote, the family reluctantly gave their pet to some friends. The very next evening, Reuther was shot in the head as he sat reading in his home. The bullet took out his right eye and parts of his jaw. A neighbor who volunteered a detailed description of the assailants to the police was never contacted for follow-up questioning and began receiving anonymous phone calls warning him to shut up. And I would note, too, in a footnote there, according to Victor, Ralph Winstead spent 8 years investigating the Reuther shootings for the United Auto Workers. In December of 1957, Winstead's body was recovered from Lake St. Clair. His death was declared, quote, accidental, unquote, and no investigation was made. Continuing with the main text of the article, 2 days after Victor was shot, the U.S. Senate unanimously adopted a resolution requesting the FBI to investigate both attacks. U.S. Attorney General Tom Clark, the governor of Michigan, and the UAW itself also demanded an investigation. Although Attorney General Clark, FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover's putative boss, pointed to possible violations of the Fugitive Felon Act and several other federal statutes, Hoover refused to move, claiming a lack of jurisdiction because no federal laws had been broken. Neither the FBI nor the Detroit police followed up on any of the leads uncovered by UAW investigators, nor did they come up with any of their own. No corporate officials were ever questioned. Ford strongman Harry Bennett, who had been implicated in the 1938 attempt against Walter, was never interrogated. In fact, Bennett was Hoover's golfing buddy and was considered a valuable ally who gave the FBI access to his files on, quote, communist, unquote, activity, consisting mostly of dossiers on labor activists. At the end of 1949, an attempt to bomb UAW headquarters in Detroit was filed by an anonymous call to a Detroit Times reporter. According to the caller, the explosive was, quote, planted when the big guy, Walter, was in the building, unquote. Investigations conducted by the police and the FBI produced not a clue. Under Reuther's leadership, the UAW not only grew into the largest union in the Western world with 1.2 million members, but it also became a powerful political organization. By 1952, as president of both the UAW and the entire CIO, Reuther had become, in the words of one historian, quote, the most influential labor figure in the country, unquote. He used his position to promote progressive stances on a wide range of domestic and foreign policy issues. UAW locals around the country formed political action committees that lobbied lawmakers and helped elect candidates friendly to organized labor. At the same time, Walter and his brother Roy were building allegiances between labor, church, and civic groups and ethnic minorities. Throughout the 1960s, the UAW lent financial and moral support to the civil rights movement. Reuther worked closely with Martin Luther King Jr., joining him in all the great civil rights marches, and serving as a longtime member of the NAACP's board of directors, whose meetings the FBI routinely bugged. Reuther sparked the creation of a citizens' board of inquiry into hunger and malnutrition. The board's findings that millions of Americans were not getting enough to eat spurred Congress into enacting reforms. The UAW leader pioneered a variety of innovative programs, including employer-funded health and pension plans, cost-of-living allowances, and a guaranteed annual wage. He fought for federally funded affordable housing, nationalized health care, government ownership of monopolistic industries, worker participation in economic planning, and other proposals for redistributing power and wealth, all of which were taken as threats to ruling class interests, as indeed they were. Under Walter and Victor's leadership, the UAW became one of the strongest proponents of the 1963 Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. UAW members marched in peace demonstrations and voted funds to support anti-war campaigns. Abroad, Ruther was the U.S.'s best-known and best-liked labor leader in a number of non-aligned countries. In India, he told an appreciative audience that U.S. foreign policy in Asia placed undue emphasis on military power and, quote, doubtful military allies, unquote, to the neglect of, quote, reliable democratic friends, unquote. These activities earned Ruther powerful political enemies. During the 1956 presidential campaign, Vice President Richard Nixon told Republican stalwarts that the UAW leader, not Democratic presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson, was, quote, the man to beat, unquote, because of his organizing power and, quote, big money, unquote. In 1958, at a GOP fundraiser, Senator Barry Goldwater declared that, quote, Walter Ruther and the UAW CIO are a more dangerous menace than anything Soviet Russia might do to America, unquote. Other members of Congress warned of Ruther's, quote, dream of establishing a socialist labor government in the U.S., unquote. A double-page ad in the Wall Street Journal echoed the same theme. Under an inch-high headline reading, Will You Let Walter Ruther Get Away With It, unquote, the ad warned, quote, Walter Ruther is already within reach of controlling your Congress. The American labor movement has now become a political movement with the objective of establishing a socialist labor government in control of the economic and social life of this nation, unquote. For his activities at home and abroad, as Victor recalled, quote, the right wing never lost its violent, bitter taste against Walter. Nor did J. Edgar Hoover, who stalked Ruther for some 40 years using undercover informants and illegal bugging equipment. Hoover successfully blocked Ruther's appointment to several presidential boards and commissions by secretly circulating disinformation packets to the White House and members of Congress, featuring the doctored, quote, for a Soviet America letter, and testimony by individuals falsely accusing Walter of communist affiliations. During World War II, Hoover made preparations to put all three Ruther brothers in custodial detention. He was ultimately dissuaded from doing so by John Bugas, B-U-G-A-S, chief FBI agent in Detroit. Both the CIA and the FBI monitored Ruther's foreign travel, taking note of public comments of his that, quote, might be construed as contrary to the foreign policy of the United States, unquote. In his early Detroit days, Walter had formed an alliance with communists within the union in order to combat conservative labor factions and company bosses. In 1938, he severed this association, and some years later, after gaining control of the UAW board, he launched a purge of dedicated UAW organizers who were communists or close to the party. In 1949, he played a key role in the expulsion of 11 CIO unions accused of being communist-led. Over the years, Ruther denounced communism at every opportunity, seeking to legitimate his own status as a loyal American. But for the industrialists, financiers, and leading politicos, it made little difference whether their wealth and power was challenged by, quote, communist subversives, unquote, or, quote, loyal Americans, unquote. It was not an obsession with communism that caused them to hate and fear Ruther, but an obsession with maintaining their privileged place in the politico-economic status quo. At the same time, Ruther was critical of right-wing radicalism. In 1961, Attorney General Robert Kennedy asked him, Victor, and Joseph Rau, R-A-U-H, an attorney for the UAW, to investigate the ultra-right. Walter was a close friend and advisor to the Kennedys. The resulting report warned of radical right elements inside the military and urged the president to dismiss generals and admirals who engaged in rightist political activities. The report also faulted J. Edgar Hoover for exaggerating the domestic communist menace at every turn, unquote, thus contributing, quote, to the public's frame of mind upon which the radical right feeds, unquote. From the first days of the AFL-CIO merger in 1955, irreconcilable political differences existed between Ruther and AFL-CIO President George Meany, a Cold War hawk. Under Meany, the AFL-CIO had entered an unholy alliance with the CIA in order to bolster conservative, anti-communist unions in other countries. These unions, Victor Ruther concluded, were run by people who were, quote, well-soaked with both U.S. corporate and CIA juices. It was, in effect, an exercise in trade union colonialism, unquote. In early 1968, The UAW withdrew from the AFL-CIO and joined forces with the Teamsters and two smaller unions to form the Alliance for Labor Action, or ALA, with a membership totaling over 4 million. The Teamsters gave Reuther a free hand on political and social issues. With Nixon in the White House and the bombings in Indochina escalating to unprecedented levels, Reuther ran ads in the national media and appeared before congressional committees to denounce the war and call for drastic cuts in the military budget. While the AFL-CIO proclaimed its support for Nixon's escalation of the war and his anti-ballistic missile program, the ALA lobbied hard against both. Nixon's invasion of Cambodia and the killing of four Kent State students prompted Reuther, the day before his death, to telegram the White House condemning the war, the invasion, and, quote, the bankruptcy of our policy of force and violence in Vietnam, unquote. By 1970, Reuther was seen more than ever as a threat to the dominant political agenda, earning him top place on Nixon's enemy list. The struggles of Walter Reuther's life provide ample cause to give more than cursory attention to the questionable circumstances of his death. First, as president of the largest union in the country, Reuther had the resources for advancing his causes on the national scene, as did few others. He was an extraordinarily effective proponent of socioeconomic equality and an outspoken critic of the military-industrial complex, the arms race, the CIA, the entire national security state, and the Vietnam War. For these stands, he earned the enmity of people in high places. Second, in the years before the fatal crash, there had been assassination attempts against Walter and Victor. Victor believes the attempt against him was intended as a message to Walter. In each of these instances, state and federal law enforcement agencies were at best lackadaisical in their investigative efforts, suggesting the possibility of official collusion or at least tolerance for the criminal deeds. Third, like the suspicious air crash a year and a half earlier, the fatal crash may also have involved a faulty altimeter in a small plane. It is a remarkable coincidence that Reuther would have been in two planes with the exact same malfunction in that brief time. Fourth, and most significantly, the National Transportation Safety Board investigation of the fatal May 1970 crash turned up disturbing evidence. When investigators disassembled the captain's altimeter, they found no fewer than seven abnormalities. Most significantly, investigators found a brass screw lying loose in the altimeter case. Although the report notes that with a loosened screw, quote, the altimeter would have read high by 225 to 250 feet, unquote, the investigators did not say who or what had loosened it. They did, however, manage to eliminate the crash itself as the cause. The screw, quote, locks the movable aluminum calibration arm in place when the instrument is calibrated. The threads within the screw hole were torn and ragged. Deposits of aluminum particles were observed on the threads of the screw. Testing to see if the heat of the crash might have caused the screw to come loose, investigators placed a similar calibration arm mechanism in an oven and heated it for 2 hours at 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. Quote, this screw was found to be tight when examined, unquote. When the test screw was removed, quote, aluminum deposits were found on its threads. The hole from which it was removed displayed torn and broken threads similar to those of the accident calibration arm, unquote, indicating that the loose screw in Reuther's plane had been unscrewed and not forced loose by the crash. Since the crash itself did not cause the screw to come loose, it must have been removed or loosened by deliberate human effort. Further examination revealed six other unusual defects in the altimeter. One, an incorrect pivot was installed at the end of a rocking in one end of a rocking shaft. An end stone was missing from the opposite end of the rocking shaft. A ring jewel within the mechanism was installed off-center. A second rocking shaft rear support pivot was incorrect. The wrong kind of link pin, which holds a spring clip in place at the pneumatic capsule, was installed. An end stone, which supports a shaft within the mechanism, was installed upside down. The odds that this many abnormalities could accidentally or coincidentally appear in a single altimeter are extremely low. With notable understatement, the investigators concluded that, quote, such conditions undoubtedly caused extensive friction in the altimeter mechanism. The board believes that while the evidence is not conclusive, the captain's altimeter was probably reading inaccurately. Unquote. There were other problems. The pilots chose the only lighted approach, runway 5, but it lacked both runway and identifier lights, and a visual approach path indicator. VAPIs give pilots their proper flight angle and help determine altitude. The main approach, runway 23, had a VAPI, but one of the runway lights was out. That the pilots were not notified of this fault, as is customary, suggests that the light broke near to landing time. In its opening synopsis, the NTSB report emphasized the, quote, lack of visual cues, unquote, as a cause of the accident. But the synopsis is misleading. The body of the report noted that in the absence of sufficient visual cues, quote, use of the altimeter is a necessity, unquote. And if the pilot was using the altimeter to determine altitude during the approach, then, quote, lack of visual cues for altitude determination must be considered to have had little effect, unquote. However, quote, an altimeter which read too high, unquote, could have caused the pilot mistakenly to think he had sufficient altitude for a safe landing. Quote, in view of the condition of the captain's altimeter, such a situation is highly possible, unquote. Aside from the altimeter, the report found no other defects in the aircraft. The Learjet, quote, was properly certified, certificated, and airworthy, unquote, and, quote, there was no malfunction of the aircraft prior to the accident, unquote. Nor was there evidence of crew incapacity or error. Medical records and postmortem examinations of the pilot and first officer found no evidence of disease or physical disability, and both crew members had been free from flight duties for approximately 24 hours prior to the flight. Captain George Evans had more than 2,000 hours of flight time on Learjets and more than 140 hours in the previous 3 months. And both pilots had flown into the Pellston Airport many times under far worse conditions. An Associated Press story carried in the New York Times under the headline, quote, no sabotage found in Reuther crash, unquote, stated that the NTSB, quote, said today that it had found no indication of sabotage to explain the Jet Air taxi crash, unquote. The Times story is seriously misleading. In fact, the final NTSB report utters not a word about sabotage one way or the other. It notes how numerous unusual defects in the altimeter may have caused a malfunction, but it says nothing about what caused the defects themselves, except to rule out crash heat as a factor in disassembling the locking screw. The report never asks whether the altimeter was tampered with, yet it proffers a good deal of evidence to suggest that it was. In effect, the investigators ignored their own findings. Earlier on the day of the fatal crash, the same ill-fated Learjet carrying popular singer Glenn Campbell had flown into Detroit with no report of a faulty altimeter. Victor Reuther noted that there was sufficient time between flights for tampering with the altimeter. He also pointed out that because they have so many clients and different pilots, rental planes are inspected with unusual care and frequency. The pilots demanded as much. It is unlikely that an altimeter with 7 defects would have gone undetected if properly inspected before the flight. Victor added, quote, I was never convinced that there had been a thorough investigation by federal authorities. There had been too many direct attempts on Walter's life, and there was too much evidence of tampering with the rental plane, unquote. In a follow-up interview, Victor Reuther further noted, quote, animosity from government had been present for some time before the fatal crash. It was not only Walter's stand on Vietnam and Cambodia that angered Nixon, but also I had exposed some CIA elements inside labor, and this was also associated with Walter. Although Walter knew I was right, he felt that I had put him in an impossible position. He said, quote, you're taking on an agency that can forge any document to prove we are liars, unquote. But I think he was glad to see the information come out. Checking into the Vendetta is no easy task. The FBI still refuses to turn over nearly 200 pages of documents, including the copious correspondence between field offices and Hoover regarding Reuther's death. And many of the documents it has released are totally inked out. It is hard to fathom what national security concern is involved or why the FBI and CIA must still keep so many secrets about Walter Reuther. Reuther's death appears as part of a truncation of liberal and radical leadership that included the murders of 4 other national figures, President John Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and Senator Robert Kennedy, and dozens of leaders in the Black Panther Party and in various community organizations. Whether Reuther's death was part of a broader agenda to decapitate and demoralize the mass movements of that day, or whether such an agenda existed at all, are questions that go beyond the scope of our inquiry. But Victor's belief, shared by Walter's daughter Elizabeth Reuther Dickmeyer and other members of the family, that the crash was no accident, does not seem implausible. Despite the limited investigation, there is enough evidence to suggest that foul play was involved. The death of this dedicated and effective progressive labor leader raises disquieting questions about the criminal nature of state power in what purports to be a democracy. I've been reading an article by Dr. Michael Parenti and his colleague Peggy Noten entitled The Wonderful Life and Strange Death of Walter Reuther. This is from Covert Action Quarterly's issue number 54 from the fall of 1995. Listeners who would like to contact Covert Action can do so at the following address. Covert Action Quarterly is located at 1500 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, room 732, Washington, D.C., 20005. Once again, the address for Covert Action Quarterly, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, room 732, Washington, D.C., 20005. Listeners who would like to contact me by email, I now have an email address. The email address to contact me at, all lowercase letters, demory, D-E-M-O-R-Y, at well, W-E-L-L, dot C-O-M. Once again, my email address, demory, D-E-M-O-R-Y, at well, dot com. Listeners who would like to correspond with me should do so at the following address, so that is listeners who would like to use, quote, snail mail, unquote, write to my attention, my last name is E-M-O-R-Y, at care of, I should say, KFJC-FM, Kangaroo Fred John Charles FM, 12345, that's 12345, El Monte Road, capital E-L, capital M-O-N-T-E Road, that's in Los Altos Hills, zip code 94022. Once again, write to my attention, and my last name E-M-O-R-Y, care of KFJC-FM, 12345, El Monte Road, capital E-L, capital M-O-N-T-E Road, that's in Los Altos Hills, 94022. Of course, that's in California. Very shortly, I will have a new address for people to contact with regard to the half-hour segments. This is not the address to which people should write for the archive shows, but rather very soon I will have a new address for the half-hour segments. Those are now going to be distributed by someone other than Archives on Audio. So please stay tuned for that. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.